Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Happy Thursday, everyone. 12:09 on WGN Radio, 720. You can see a pretty gorgeous day outside right now, at least more sunshine than we've had the last few days. Hope you're enjoying your Thursday. And a little bit later on the show, we're going to have Dennis Rockin, the real estate reporter at Crane's Inn, to talk about some kind of weak numbers, although some still big home sales out there, especially to our neighbors to the north. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But up first is Maggie Reardon, senior reporter at CNET. Maggie, thanks for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Maggie, I want to start with the story that makes the least amount of sense to me. That way you have as much time to explain it as humanly possible. The Google quantum computer, it's making a lot of big waves. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. People are calling it, you know, maybe Google's Sputnik moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really showing us that this is possible and could, you know, be commercially available sooner than maybe people thought.
What is a quantum computer?
Well, and it has to do with, you know, using quantum physics. So, you know, when you look at a traditional computer, it's computing ones and zeros. This is looking at much smaller particles and sort of computing on that level. So the benefit of it is that it can really speed up computing exponentially. So you're able to do things a lot faster. And that's what Google demonstrated in the article that it published.
Right. And they were really kind of testing I was going to ask you, by the way, what quantum physics were, but I thought we'd stop there. About this chip. Now, in terms of what they were testing, I mean, they're talking about computations that don't quite have real-world applications right now, but they will one day.
Right. And it's really, again, you know, if you think of it like Sputnik, in fact, that's what one of the Google spokespeople said was, you know, Sputnik really just was a satellite that circled the Earth and that was it, right? But
yeah,
it was a huge breakthrough. And that's what we've got here where, you know, they demonstrated that it's possible. And at this point, that's, you know, a pretty big achievement.
Yeah, that's a fair point because Sputnik in 57 literally just beeps as it goes around the Earth. And 12 years later, man is on the moon. So these things, while they seem far away, can move at a pretty rapid pace once you make those initial breakthroughs.
Yeah, and, you know, they're saying that this is really going to be something that, you know, speeds up computing power for things like artificial intelligence and random number generation, which is really important for security and encryption, coming up with material science, doing stuff with, you know, breakthroughs in new drugs. So, I mean, the applications are pretty mind-blowing. And, you know, so who knows what will happen in the next decade.
If anyone's still confused, go to CNET.com. You guys have great articles. We'll go to the next one. We started with space. We might as well continue on. NASA's space probe for exploring Venus should be ready by 2023, which when I hear 2023, that seems so far away. But, boy, we're just about to turn the calendar to 2020. And that's big news for NASA.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is a big deal too. So, you know, this another frontier of exploration, and it looks like this device, you know, this module can actually survive on Venus's surface, or should be able to survive on Venus's surface for something like 60 days. So it collects a lot of data, and we can learn a whole lot more about Venus.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. Obviously, a lot of focus is on Mars, but we haven't really been to Venus except for in its, you know, circling around it all that often on the surface, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, again, this is a big deal, and it's, you know, it's right in our neighborhood, right?
Yeah, so to speak. Yeah, and actually, I did a deep dive when I saw we were going to be talking about Venus, because I honestly didn't know which was closer, Mars or Venus. I think we were always told that Venus is closer. And you know what I found out, Maggie, by talking to folks at NASA, by that I mean the Google, what they were saying, is that Venus, they considered our closest neighbor in that it gets closer to us, but actually Mercury spends more time as the planet close to us due to the elliptical nature of our planets. How interesting is that?
That's super interesting. That is not something that I learned in third grade.
Yes, yeah, they just kept it, my very elegant mother or whatever, they kept it pretty simple when they taught you the planets. Okay, let's talk about, this is big testimony yesterday. It kind of got drowned out by a bunch of other headlines, but if you're into the tech world, or really, I mean, we all use Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg testifying yesterday, it really was a real interesting affair happening on Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah. He got really, you know, raked over the coals. I mean, everybody sort of took a turn beating up on him yesterday. The hearing was really supposed to be about Libra, the digital payments thing that Facebook wants to introduce. But it really ended up being about sort of all of Facebook's ills. And everybody sort of took a turn bashing him. Exactly.
How do you do? I mean, I guess it's a lot of it came down to the idea of, you know, political ads and people that pay for them and whether or not a politician is lying, if that's acceptable or not. I mean, his answers, if you gave him the chance to actually answer, so a lot of that stuff sort of made sense. But boy, they couldn't wait to go one after the other.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I sat through the whole thing. It was a 4-hour hearing, and I had watched him, you know, there last year. I mean, he was in D.C. a year ago. And, you know, a real big difference this time. I mean, he didn't have a lot of answers for things. And it seemed like the Congress people who were questioning him really knew what they were talking about and were really sort of, you know, sticking it to him.
Yeah, usually
so,
that,
I mean,
that
I don't think he did that well.
Yeah, usually that script is flipped. Yeah, I only saw a few of the sound bites. Interesting. So were you in the room when it was going on?
Well, I mean, I was watching it online. Yeah. and sat through the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, he really, you know, he got hammered on things like, you know, civil rights and diversity. He got hammered on things, you know, like his comments that he made a week ago about free speech and whether, you know, defending Facebook's decision to allow ads that are not true and to not fact check them. And there were a lot of folks who really hammered in on that. And then also, you know, talking about Libra. I mean, this is going to be a new digital payments system. And some folks are really worried that it's going to be used by drug dealers and terrorists. And it didn't seem that Zuckerberg really had great answers for how to mitigate some of the security things. And I think that, you know, really sort of troubled some of the folks here on this committee who are really in charge of making sure that our banking and monetary system doesn't fall apart.
How consequential are these hearings in terms of Facebook's operations? I mean, they are a big deal in the press, obviously, and they're kind of a big moment for a Republican or a Democrat to have a talking point that they went up against Mark Zuckerberg. Do they matter in terms of policy? I imagine they have to.
They do, and I think it also matters in terms of what the public understands. I mean, these are really heavy issues, and it certainly, you know, brings those issues out into the public forum and allow the public to debate them and to see them from different sides. So I think that they are important, you know, and so when you see an executive who is struggling a little bit to answer questions, I mean, I think that really, you know, can hurt some of the trust that the public has. And, you know, he acknowledged that, you know, that Facebook really has a huge trust issue here. And that's what those representatives were really getting at.
Now, Maggie, we're going to talk about the FCC next. And I have this theory that I think everyone has this theory that everyone hates regulation until it's something that interests you and you need it. Or everyone loves states' rights until they realize that federal regulation might work better for what they're trying to do. And it seems like that's what the FCC chairman is arguing here when he's trying to get away from a patchwork of local and state regulations on internet technologies. Am I wrong?
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to see a pretty staunch conservative and federalist, you know, Ajit Pai, really saying that, no, what we really need here is, you know, federal jurisdiction. But, you know, what it comes down to is he doesn't want there to be regulation anywhere. So mm-hmm. Whether it's at the state or whether it's the federal level. And that's what he was really saying in these comments the other day.
What sort of regulations are we talking about?
We're talking about net neutrality specifically. So, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners here are familiar. It's something that people have been talking about for a while, and that's basically the concept that, you know, service providers shouldn't be able to monkey around with your internet traffic. And there were rules in place, and then Ajit Pai came in to control of the FCC, and they dismantled those rules. There was recently a court case in federal court, and the court basically said, yes, you know, the FCC can do that, but what they can't do, because something else that they did in this order, was they said, hey, we don't think that there should be any net neutrality rules, and by the way, we don't think states can make their own rules.
Hmm.
And the court came back and said, wait a second, you know, FCC, you can get rid of the federal rules. That's fine. That's in your jurisdiction. But you can't tell states that they can't do that. And there are lots of states who are stepping in, you know, now that there's this sort of vacuum of net neutrality. And so you've got states like California and New York and Vermont who are passing laws basically to impose the regulation. And, yeah, so that's sort of the backdrop of how all this came about.
I may not agree with him overall, but I do think he has a point in talking generally about kind of controlling the internet state by state. I don't want to sound like an old congressperson back in the 90s saying it's a series of tubes or whatever it is, but, I mean, it does make sense that it is hard to kind of, I imagine, control things on a state-by-state level when we're talking about a World Wide Web.
That's true, but when you think about, you know, states do have a lot of control over a lot of things that cross state lines,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
You know, I mean, they make speed limits, right? They make, they have a lot of consumer protection laws in place that apply to consumers in their states. So not, you know, not everything is done, you know, at the federal level. And in fact, it goes to the heart of that argument of, you know, states' rights versus the federal government.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it's very interesting that someone who would normally be somebody who would say, no, states should be able to decide for themselves is basically saying that it has to be something handled at the federal level.
Fair point. All right. Stalking apps under fire from the FTC. These are apps, and you'll have to tell me if I'm wrong, though, but the steps, they're apps that some people buy, I think, with the good purpose in mind, but they kind of either have turned nefarious or they can be hidden on your phone. Talk us through this one.
Yeah, so I think that these apps were initially sort of made so that people could, like, you know, track their kids or maybe track their babysitter who has their kids or mm-hmm. something like that. But what's happened is stalkers have sort of started to use them. You know, if someone gets access to your device, you know, like let's say, you know, some sort of crazy boyfriend or girlfriend, they could hack your phone and put the software or put the app on there and then use it to track you. And, yeah, totally creepy, totally scary.
I think the scariest part is that they can get it on your phone and then there's a way to kind of hide the app from appearing so that you would know it was there, which, you know, anytime you try and delete an app, it usually comes up with a warning like, oh, you're deleting the app. Are you deleting everything that goes along with it? So it's always been my understanding that if it's on your, you know, if it's on your phone, you're going to be able to see it somewhere on one of your home pages, but that's not necessarily the case.
Right, right. And that's the whole thing. Like, that's the whole point of it is to be super stealthy. And, you know, I mean, I would say my warning to anybody is, like, even, you know, sort of tracking your own kids. Because another thing that the FTC found with this is even when people were using it legitimately, you know, the companies weren't really protecting the data very well either. So you've got all this information about where your kid has been, your teenager or whoever, and now some company has it and it's not necessarily been secure. So that's also a big risk too. So anything I would say that you have to like jailbreak your phone to be able to put on it, probably not a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. And the Federal Trade Commission has actually settled its case against its company and they've, what is the settlement terms? I mean, no, it's probably some sort of fine, but more importantly, destroy all that data that's already been collected.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I just think is super questionable.
Oh, for sure.
You know, whether they're able to do it and what happens to that data. I mean, it's, we live in a scary world now.
Yeah, we do. And I really think the next 10 or 15 to 20 years, cybersecurity is going to be one of the most important things that goes through our court system as we try and navigate through it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people like me that don't know enough about it. Luckily, there's enough people like you that do. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
720 WGN. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Good friend Dennis Rocket in from Crane's Real Estate. How are you doing?
I'm good, John. How are you?
You're feeling good. You're not getting pelted with fruit as you walk through the streets. You're just delivering the news as it is.
Yeah, I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. Don't throw fruit at the messenger.
Yes. Let's talk about Chicago real estate on the whole. Let's start with Lakeview because that's what's on my mind fresh.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to try and pretend it was going to be. So Lakeview neighborhood, obviously, for those of you that don't know, we're talking about kind of Wrigleyville off to the lake east. A gorgeous neighborhood for the most part. I'm really trying to sell it. A little bit weaker than some of its other areas.
Yeah, well, and so the real estate market in the Chicago area is quite weak this year.
Mm-hmm.
Sales overall, our home sales are down about 7% from a year ago.
The number of homes sold.
And in Lakeview, they're down nearly 12%.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big difference. At the same time, prices homes are selling at lower prices. They're taking longer to sell in Lakeview. And it's not the hardest hit neighborhood in the city. But I was looking at those sort of affluent, desirable neighborhoods on the north side as one cluster. And Lakeview is really essentially the hardest hit of those. More trouble in the Gold Coast, but that's because they're trying to sell the big old classic mansions, and those are just sitting.
Do you think that it's a lot of people that maybe have lived in Lakeview 5 to 10 years, things are going okay for them personally, and they want to upgrade to Lincoln Park or a little bit more space, or maybe are they going to the burbs? What's happening?
I think that might be a piece of it, but what agents were telling me is that, in a sense, Lakeview is sort of a victim of its own success.
Mm-hmm.
In those first really optimistic years after the housing downturn, the beginning of the turn up, the beginning of the recovery, there was sort of this rush in Lakeview, tons of new construction, more than 300 vintage homes torn down and replaced with new ones, two flats being made into single family homes, rehab of condos, that sort of stuff. So Lakeview was rising and rising and rising and may have risen above what it can really take. At the same time, let's keep in mind the real estate market is sagging overall.
Mm-hmm.
And people are cautious in Chicago these days, in part, not only, but in part because we don't know where property taxes are going.
Right.
And so if I was willing to spend a dollar on housing and I don't know whether my property taxes are going to be 5 cents or 10 cents out of that dollar, I'm paying a lower price. So I may decide I can't afford Lakeview because I don't know that with a new higher property tax bill, I can stretch the way I would in what's now more expensive Lakeview. So I'm going to look farther west. I may look Jefferson Park, Humboldt mm-hmm. Park, those kinds of places. All of those neighborhoods have new construction, have things that attract me, and I'm being conservative about my spending, so I may not buy in Lakeview.
Fair point. Chicago area home sales up, but an ellipse in the headline. Yeah. Weaker in general, and you can look at one number and feel better about yourselves, but you got to take a look at the whole picture.
Well, and that was sort of how the number was reported by the Illinois Association of Realtors on Tuesday.
Shocker.
Exactly. They reported that sales were up. But when sales were up in September from a year before. But the problem is, a year before, September 2018, was the biggest decline in home sales we've had in years. I reported that at the time. So that 1% improvement was really just coming up off a really low bottom. So it's not evidence, as I said in the story, that the market is very vibrant. It's just that it's not as bad as it was a year ago. And that's for the metro area. That's for the 9-county area. Looking only at the city, sales did plunge a year ago, September 2018, and they went lower in September 2019. Sales in September 2019 were below that very low point of September 2018, which is a little alarming. There mm-hmm. really is a slowdown. It's happening in many parts of the country. It's not happening like this.
Mm-hmm.
We're really seeing it slow down.
And when we say slowdown, it wasn't like there was a major boom like we've seen in some of the other cities either.
You know, I wish I could pull the analogy properly from Lake Michigan, but it's those days when it's not waves mm-hmm. on the lake. It's just kind of swelling and rising. But then it's a big drop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what happened. We had a very modest, compared to other cities, we had a modest improvement. When you look at the market overall, certainly we have our hot spots. We have our places where things were just go, and some places where things still are going boom. The West Loop is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, when you look at the metro area and the city at large, sort of a shallow increase followed by a shallow decrease.
Is there anything to take from it that at least, I don't know how to say that, that with a big boom, sometimes you have the reactionary bust down the other way. With this slow swelling, is there something that could be, I don't want to say we're protected from anything, because who knows what happens on a global market or a national market, but that the swells, when they come back down the other way, maybe we don't bottom out quite as low as other people.
Well, you know,
John, Am I just being optimistic about my
I'm a very old man, and I've been covering real estate for a very long time in Chicago. And I will say, in the 90s, most economists would tell you, 90s and early 2000s, most economists would say what's great about Chicago is we have this Midwestern values. We're rock-ribbed conservative. We don't bid up on houses the way they do in San Francisco, in New York, in Dallas, that kind of thing. Our prices didn't go up so much, so they wouldn't fall so much. That's what everybody said in the 90s and early 2000s. And then when the big bust of 2006 came, we fell as bad as most other cities.
Okay.
We had gone up. We hadn't gone up as much as the others had, but we came down as much as they did. So I'm not sure what's that, what that's going to mean in the near future. Certainly it means the fact that we've had only these modest increases does mean it appears that we wouldn't have a big come down. It does look like buyers, builders, and others have been relatively conservative. We're not seeing a neighborhood of $100,000 homes with a new $1 million house plunked down in the middle as much as we were in 2006. But we can hope you're right, but we already have, we have one lesson that indicates that you might be wrong.
Maybe wrong.
Yeah.
You mentioned the West Loop. Boy, ooh, that's not slowing down at all.
No, and there's one building in particular, Hayden West Loop, that surprises me. There were more there have been in the past year more sales at $1 million and up in that building than there have been in the entire Gold Coast. They've had two penthouses sell for over $4 million, and there's a third that I understand from the agents is also going to close. And they've, I can't remember, is it 12 condos have sold for $2 million or more in one building, Hayden West Loop, in the 1100 block of Washington Street. I may just have gotten that wrong.
That's Washington, Randolph, or Madison. Take your pick,
exactly.
Really. There's only five or six of them.
And the thing is that it's not just that building is like the tent pole, but it's not just that building. There also was a penthouse in another building two blocks away that sold for well over five. The number of $1 million condos sold in the West Loop just keeps rising. Each time I write a story saying, well, there's a big new number of $1 million condos sold, I then have to write another one saying, and now there are more.
Mm-hmm. I work over at CW26 in the mornings, 6 to 8 a.m. on the Jam. And when I leave around the area,
so subtle.
When I come home around 11 or noon or 1, or if I'm coming over here, I don't know if how they're going to put any more buildings in that area in terms of driving around. And I don't mean to be a NIMBY.
Somebody's going to find a way.
It's somebody. It's insane.
Something it is, and the thing is, it's great to see, because the West Loop was, of course, once upon a time a real shabby area. That's
right.
20, 25 years ago. And it makes perfect sense because downtown is right nearby. The trains are right nearby. The expressways are right nearby. You got a restaurant scene like essentially, you know, people die for in other cities or would love to have in other cities. It's a great area, and I do hope that it continues to go. The question is, how far west can it spread?
Yes, because a lot of
people... That's really the boundary.
And I don't mean to keep making this about me. I rented a place. My first place in Chicago was at Palina and Warren. So just northwest of United Center. And everyone was saying, it's going to come. It's going to come as west as Palina. And it's starting to get there. But even Ashland still seems to be that, boom, that big divider.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's space for improvement north, and or I shouldn't say for improvement, for rehab, for... gentrification, for new stuff north and south of what's classically thought of as the West Loop. The other thing is, I think we might see more fill-in on the east side of the expressway, like, you know, between Union Station and the expressway. There are some things that could still happen, some surface parking lots. I think down over the course of the next few years, we may see some of that happen.
Dennis is on the record of taking away more parking and putting more humans there, just in case anyone wants to complain.
Humans with bikes and CTA passes.
Fair point. All right. Let's take a quick commercial break. Actually, the Wintrust Business Minute here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Hey, Cubs fans, you all know the cheeky advertisement of the rain tarp on Wrigley that's covered in the Reynolds Wrap advertisement? It's supposed to be like Reynolds Wrap in your kitchen that you use to, you know, keep your leftover chicken good in the fridge. Some may have picked up on that, or not. But the parent company Reynolds Consumer Products is confident in not only their field or kitchen wraps, but also in their other products. So, the Lake Forest-based company is going public.
But with the number of questionable IPOs this year, it means nothing's guaranteed.
Welcome to Wall Street. Enter at your own risk.
And welcome to Chicago, where we don't raise property taxes. Okay, I'm sorry. I couldn't say that with a straight face. But Lori Lightfoot is trying to hold off on raising property taxes in this year's budget by pulling money from elsewhere. This is going to be one of the biggest challenges for the office. But now that the plan is announced, we'll see if she can stick to it, or if we'll get tapped again like many years in the past. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand this week, and joining us is Dennis Rockin, real estate reporter at Cranes. Let's talk about a building that got a ceremonial groundbreaking today, but this has been a long time coming, and we still might have a while to go before this building gets built, question mark.
Yeah, there is a question mark, which is not to say that I feel confident it won't get built.
Right.
It's just there are some signs that there's some hesitance.
Right.
It's a 74-story tower designed by Helmut Jahn. It's called 1000M. It's at 1000 South Michigan, which right now is a vacant lot and has been for a very long time. There were other high-rises proposed for that site. And so they... It was announced in 2015, that they would be building this, that Helmut Jahn had designed it. It eventually was shortened by about 200 feet, but it's a super cool looking building.
Yeah.
But some buildings that were announced around the same time are already complete,
mm-hmm.
and this one is just now having a ceremonial groundbreaking. A groundbreaking isn't necessarily the beginning of construction, and they did confirm for me that this is not the beginning of construction. This is strictly ceremonial. They could next week say we're starting construction, but
right.
the question right at this moment is, what's the deal here?
Right. You know? Because usually there's certain things that happen at the pageantry of a groundbreaking or the announcements that are made surrounding it, and we're not getting some of that information. Doesn't mean anything necessarily, but...
Right. It could just be that we'd like to hold our cards closer to the vest, but one of the big ones is they won't say how many units are sold. Now, you see in the story, I found a way to determine how many I think are sold,
mm-hmm.
and it's about 20% of the units. And that's a perfectly healthy figure. So
I was going to ask, yeah, is that?
I'm not sure why they won't say, but I sort of dug around in real estate records, and I'm pretty sure that that's approximately what they've sold. But they're not saying that. And at or about the time of a groundbreaking, developers typically say, "Hey, we're breaking ground on this 500 unit building. We have 100 units sold, 20%. Come on in and see the rest." That kind of thing. At 1000M, they've got about 420 units to sell. They're not saying how many are sold. And as I said, other buildings have already broken ground.
Mm-hmm.
Vista, which is just east of us here, was announced at around the same time and is going
almost
up. Will
done,
be done.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've topped out, but it's such a big building, it'll take a while.
Okay.
One Bennett Park, which is across the river, was announced at around the same time and is done. They announced at about the time of these buildings that are done, and they haven't started construction.
I have a dumb question.
Okay.
Who buys a unit in a place that isn't breaking ground yet? This happens normal. You say that 20% is normal. Who's buying that? Who would buy that?
Well, you know,
who goes in and says, "I'm going to sign that"? I can't even see any of the building yet.
Well, so one of the things we don't know is, did these people buy thinking I'll be moved in by 2019?
Right.
Right. I know that I'm gonna have a kid in college. I live way out in the suburbs. I'm going to have a kid in college by 2019, and I want a little one-bedroom in the South Loop where all the schools are. And now 2019 rolls around, and it's not available. Or we expect to retire and downsize, and we want. Or for various other reasons, some people do plan ahead two or three years. There's also people who buy planning to flip it
right after.
I buy because I think, well, if I get it now at a 2017 price, when the building opens in 2019, theoretically, values may be higher in the neighborhood and I can flip it. So for a lot of reasons, people will buy in advance.
Yeah.
One of the questions we have there is, there appear to be about 90 sold, but what is not marked sold is they're really expensive units. They're units over $4 million. They have about six of those.
Right.
Not a single one of those is marked sold. And over $4 million hasn't really happened in the South Loop. So one of the people who don't buy
right
a few years in advance would be people who are saying, "Well, will the South Loop support
that
my $4 million purchase
right
a few years from now?"
Right. We have to cut it short there, Dennis. Plenty more stories at Crane's Chicago Business. Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, John.